there would be a place for a payer, right? Not an insurance company. A place for where the money goes and somebody that manages the payouts. But that's just not the same thing as a gatekeeper like we have with the insurance companies right now. So somebody could get in the mix of being the payer, maybe.
Okay. Tom and Kate, we're starting to run out of time. So kind of last thing I'd like to throw it out. For listeners who are interested in pushing this and supporting this, and I think we all agree this is the way we need to go, what should we be doing next?
Healthcare for All Oregon website. Go sign up, put your name in our database so then we can increase his signatures and see how much support we have.
That is hcao.org. hcao.org. We need your name in the database so we can get ready for 2020.
Tom and Kate, thank you so much for your time and thank you for coming in and sharing this information with our listeners.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Girl. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at Tonic Lounge in Portland. Next Level 3.0 is a collaboration with Flawless Shade, the House of Flora, and the House of Ada, featuring KBOO's Dina B and DJ Gila River Monster, and more DJs and performers. Costumes are highly recommended. Again, that's Next Level 3.0's party, Vogue Beach Please, on Saturday, July 1st from 9 p.m. to 2 a.m. at the Tonic Lounge, 3100 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6:01, and coming up next is two back-to-back episodes of This Way Out.
I'd stand on a street corner in the heavy Kansas humidity, surrounded by a few dozen relatives, with my tiny fists clutching a sign that I couldn't read yet. Gays are worthy of death. I can't help but see in our public discourse so many of the same destructive impulses that ruled my former church. Reaching out to someone we disagree with is an option that is available to all of us. Escalating disgust and intractable conflict are not what we want for ourselves or our country or our next generation.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Serbia's president picks a lesbian PM, trans rights advance in Canada and Oregon, and healing hatred 140 characters at a time. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Michael Lebeau.
And I'm Michelle Yater.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending June 17, 2017. Serbia's current Minister of Public Administration is set to become the world's fifth ever out prime minister. President Aleksandar Vučić, who leads the right-wing Serbian Progressive Party, officially nominated open lesbian Ana Brnabić this week to lead the new government, pending formal approval by Serbia's parliament in the coming week. Vučić raised eyebrows last August when he named the proudly out Brnabić to his cabinet, a first for the conservative Balkan nation. Amnesty International is among several global human rights groups to criticize Serbia for offering no legal protections for its sexual and gender minorities. Private consensual adult same-gender sex only became legal in the country in 1994. The Serbian Orthodox Church has staunchly opposed any efforts to advance LGBTQ rights. The 41-year-old Brnabic is her country's former Businesswoman of the Year and was educated in both the UK and the US. She'll assist Vučić in his declared efforts to improve LGBTQ rights in Serbia as a key to their country's entry into the European Union.
Openly gay Leo Varadkar was formally elected as the Republic of Ireland's Prime Minister this week after winning the nomination earlier this month of his governing Fine Gael party. There were 57 votes in his favor, 50 against, including all of the MPs of the country's second largest and opposition party, and 47 abstentions. So his election can hardly be described as a landslide. The 38-year-old Varadkar also made history as the country's first ethnic minority prime minister. He's the son of an Indian immigrant father and Irish mother, and the nation's youngest ever head of state. His politics have been described as center-right. Varadkar was instrumental in the campaign to make heavily Roman Catholic Ireland the first nation in the world in 2015 to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples by a popular vote, coming out in the process. Ireland had only decriminalized private consensual adult same-gender sex in 1993. Current Luxembourg Prime Minister Xavier Bettel is gay and married. Iceland had a lesbian PM from 2009 to 2013, Jóhanna Sigurðardóttir. And Belgium's openly gay Elio Di Rupo served as prime minister from 2011 to 2014.
A record 45 out-and-proud queer candidates were elected to the House of Commons in Britain's June 8th elections. But LGBTQ activists say that Prime Minister Theresa May's proposed coalition government with Northern Ireland's notoriously anti-queer Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, is cause for alarm. May expected a better outcome, but her Conservative Party lost its parliamentary majority, and she's forced to find a minority party with which to form a coalition government. The DUP has blocked efforts to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples in Northern Ireland, opposes reproductive rights for women, and supports laws to protect the so-called religious freedom to discriminate against LGBTQ people. Gay and bisexual MPs from the opposition Labour Party called on May this week to abandon plans to form a government with the DUP because of the party's terrible record on equality. But May has already tapped, virulently, anti-gay DUP MP David Leddington to be her new Justice Secretary. However, London's Telegraph newspaper reported that Scottish Conservative leader Ruth Davidson, who's out and engaged, said she has received assurances from May that a coalition government with the DUP will not roll back LGBTQ rights.
Canada, led by its charismatic young Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, continues to be among the world's top nations to protect LGBTQ rights. The Yukon became the last territory or province in the country to add explicit anti-discrimination protections for trans people to its Human Rights Code when Bill 5 passed its third and final reading on June 13th. As is the case elsewhere in Canada, the legislation also allows trans people to change their legal gender without having to undergo gender-confirming surgery. And 2 days later, a federal trans rights bill passed the Canadian Senate by an overwhelming vote of 67 to 11. Bill C-16 had already passed in the House of Commons and awaits the formality of royal assent. It adds prohibitions against discrimination on the basis of gender identity and expression to the Canadian Human Rights Act, amends the criminal code to extend protections to trans people against hate speech, and allows judges to consider when imposing sentence whether the crime was motivated by hatred of the victim's gender identity or expression. Passage of the legislation culminates a 12-year campaign by equal rights activists. Opponents charged that the legislation threatens free speech rights.
Oregon became the first state in the U.S. to allow its residents to mark their gender as not specified on applications for driver's licenses and other state ID cards. Under the new rule approved by the State Transportation Commission, Oregonians who select the new option will have an X appear instead of an MRF on those documents. The rule takes effect on July 1st. While the change didn't require legislative action or gubernatorial approval, out bisexual Governor Kate Brown praised it as advancing a society that upholds the rights, liberties, and dignity of each of its people. She made history herself last year by becoming the first out LGBTQ person to be elected governor of a U.S. state. California's state Senate recently voted to add a similar third gender option on state IDs, sending it to the state assembly, where it's likely to pass. Governor Jerry Brown is expected to sign the bill, making the state the first in the nation to establish a third gender option through legislative action. The California Family Council, a conservative Christian group, opposes the move, arguing that government documents need to reflect biological facts for identification.
Meanwhile, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill into law this week that allows adoption agencies to reject applications from prospective gay or lesbian parents. Even agencies that receive state funds can now deny adoptions and other services to children and parents based on sincerely held religious beliefs. The law is written so broadly, critics charge, that it also allows overt discrimination against single parents, interfaith couples, divorced people, and members of other faiths.
Steve Scalise, the Republican House Majority Whip, who was shot and seriously wounded by a gunman at a congressional baseball practice this week, may owe his life to a queer black woman. Scalise is one of the most vocal opponents of LGBTQ rights in the country, and once compared himself to the unapologetic racist David Duke without baggage. Crystal Greiner, a Capitol Police officer, was one of two special agents on Scalise's security detail who helped take down the shooter James Hutchinson. People at the scene said that Greiner and fellow Special Agent David Bailey prevented an all-out massacre that day, engaging in a firefight with the shooter before killing him. Both officers sustained wounds in the fight. Greiner, like Scalise, was still in a hospital recovering, with wife Tiffany by her side, when President Donald Trump and his wife, Melania, paid a surprise visit. CNN initially reported that the first couple brought two large bouquets of white flowers for the injured lawmaker's wife, as well as for Crystal Greiner, a U.S. Capitol police officer also wounded in the gun attack. The cable news outlet later acknowledged that the Trumps spent time with Greiner and her wife, in addition to the Scalise family, during their unexpected visit to MedStar Washington Hospital Center. Scalise remains in serious condition, but doctors say, as of this report, that he's improving.
And finally, a group of singers gathered at the Sejong Center for the Performing Arts in central Seoul, South Korea, on the afternoon of June 3rd to perform Over the Rainbow. It was a lyrical kickoff to the two-day Hand-in-Hand Seoul 2017 Choral Festival. The event was first held in 2015 in Taipei and brings together LGBTQ choruses from across Asia. Eight vocal groups performed this year, including Hong Kong's Harmonix, China's Beijing Queer Chorus, Taiwan's G Major, the homegrown G Voice, and Unni Choir, a group of rainbow feminists who reject marriage. The World Family Festival was also taking place at the same time as Hand in Hand in Seoul. It was organized by fundamentalist Christian groups to promote the traditional family in the face of the tsunami of homosexuality.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 17th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm Michael Lebeau.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine.
Why don't you be like me? Why don't you stop and see? Why don't you hate who I hate you? Why can't you be free?
Even if the names Westboro Baptist Church and Reverend Fred Phelps don't ring a bell, their infamous signs reading "God Hates Fags" have come to represent the worst kind of homophobic, anti-Semitic, anti-modern narrative in general fundamentalist Christianity. The Phelps family is the congregation, and for decades they've traveled from their home in Topeka, Kansas to stage protest demonstrations aimed at high-impact targets like military funerals. They even picketed the funeral of hate crime victim Matthew Shepard. A few family members have defected over the years to tell their stories of growing up in bondage to hate. Megan Phelps Roper went beyond that in a TED Talk published in March of this year to share what she's learned about defeating bigotry.
I was a blue-eyed, chubby-cheeked 5-year-old when I joined my family on the picket line for the first time. My mom made me leave my dolls in the minivan. I'd stand on a street corner in the heavy Kansas humidity, surrounded by a few dozen relatives, with my tiny fists clutching a sign that I couldn't read yet. Gays are worthy of death. This was the beginning. Our protest soon became a daily occurrence and an international phenomenon, and as a member of Westboro Baptist Church, I became a fixture on picket lines across the country. The end of my anti-gay picketing career, and life as I knew it, came 20 years later, triggered in part by strangers on Twitter who showed me the power of engaging the other. In my home, life was framed as an epic spiritual battle between good and evil. The good was my church and its members, and the evil was everyone else. My church's antics were such that we were constantly at odds with the world, and that reinforced our otherness on a daily basis. Make a difference between the unclean and the clean, the verse says. And so we did. From baseball games to military funerals, we trekked across the country with neon protest signs in hand to tell others exactly how unclean they were and exactly why they were headed for damnation. This was the focus of our whole lives. This was the only way for me to do good in a world that sits in Satan's lap. And like the rest of my 10 siblings, I believed what I was taught with all my heart, and I pursued Westboro's agenda with a special sort of zeal. In 2009, that zeal brought me to Twitter. Initially, the people I encountered on the platform were just as hostile as I expected. They were the digital version of the screaming hordes I'd been seeing at protests since I was a kid. But in the midst of that digital brawl, a strange pattern developed. Someone would arrive at my profile with the usual rage and scorn. I would respond with a custom mix of Bible verses, pop culture references, and smiley faces. They would be understandably confused and caught off guard, but then a conversation would ensue. And it was civil, full of genuine curiosity on both sides. How had the other come to such outrageous conclusions about the world? Sometimes the conversation even bled into real life. People I'd sparred with on Twitter would come out to the picket line to see me when I protested in their city. A man named David was one such person. He ran a blog called Julicious, and after several months of heated but friendly arguments online, he came out to see me at a picket in New Orleans. He brought me a Middle Eastern dessert from Jerusalem, where he lives, and I brought him kosher chocolate and held a God Hates Jews sign. There was no confusion about our positions, but the line between friend and foe was becoming blurred. We'd started to see each other as human beings, and it changed the way we spoke to one another. It took time, but eventually these conversations planted seeds of doubt in me. My friends on Twitter took the time to understand Westboro's doctrines, and in doing so, they were able to find inconsistencies I'd missed my entire life. Why did we advocate the death penalty for gays when Jesus said, "Let he who is without sin cast the first stone"? How could we claim to love our neighbor while at the same time praying for God to destroy them? The truth is that the care shown to me by these strangers on the internet was itself a contradiction. It was growing evidence that people on the other side were not the demons I'd been led to believe. These realizations were life-altering. Once I saw that we were not the ultimate arbiters of divine truth, but flawed human beings, I couldn't pretend otherwise. I couldn't justify our actions, especially our cruel practice of protesting funerals and celebrating human tragedy. These shifts in my perspective contributed to a larger erosion of trust in my church, and eventually, it made it impossible for me to stay. In spite of overwhelming grief and terror, I left Westboro in 2012. In those days just after I left, the instinct to hide was almost paralyzing. I wanted to hide from the judgment of my family, who I knew would never speak to me again, people whose thoughts and opinions had meant everything to me. And I wanted to hide from the world I'd rejected for so long, people who had no reason at all to give me a second chance after a lifetime of antagonism. And yet, unbelievably, they did. The world had access to my past because it was all over the internet, thousands of tweets and hundreds of interviews, everything from local TV news to the Howard Stern Show. But so many embraced me with open arms anyway. I wrote an apology for the harm I'd caused, but I also knew that an apology could never undo any of it. All I could do was try to build a new life and find a way somehow to repair some of the damage. People had every reason to doubt my sincerity, but most of them didn't. And given my history, it was more than I could have hoped for. Forgiveness and the benefit of the doubt. It still amazes me. I spent my first year away from home, adrift with my younger sister, who had chosen to leave with me. We walked into an abyss, but we were shocked to find light and a way forward in the same communities we targeted for so long. David, my Jewlicious friend from Twitter, invited us to spend time among a Jewish community in Los Angeles. We slept on couches in the home of a Hasidic rabbi and his wife and their four kids. The same rabbi that I'd protested 3 years earlier with a sign that said, "Your rabbi is a whore." We spent long hours talking about theology and Judaism and life while we washed dishes in their kosher kitchen and chopped vegetables for dinner. They treated us like family. They held nothing against us. And again, I was astonished. That period was full of turmoil, but one part I've returned to often is a surprising realization I had during that time, that it was a relief and a privilege to let go of the harsh judgments that instinctively ran through my mind about nearly every person I saw. I realized that now I needed to learn. I needed to listen. This has been at the front of my mind lately because I can't help but see in our public discourse so many of the same destructive impulses that ruled my former church. We celebrate tolerance and diversity more than at any other time in memory, and still we grow more and more divided. We want good things, justice, equality, freedom, dignity, prosperity, but the path we've chosen looks so much like the one I walked away from 4 years ago. We've broken the world into us and them, only emerging from our bunkers long enough to lob rhetorical grenades at the other camp. We write off half the country as out-of-touch liberal elites or racist, misogynist bullies. No nuance, no complexity, no humanity. Even when someone does call for empathy and understanding for the other side, the conversation nearly always devolves into a debate about who deserves more empathy. And just as I learned to do, we routinely refuse to acknowledge the flaws in our positions or the merits in our opponents. Compromise is anathema. We even target people on our own side when they dare to question the party line. This path has brought us cruel sniping, deepening polarization, and even outbreaks of violence. I remember this path. It will not take us where we want to go. What gives me hope is that we can do something about this. The good news is that it's simple, and the bad news is that it's hard. We have to talk and listen to people we disagree with. It's hard because we often can't fathom how the other side came to their positions. It's hard because righteous indignation, that sense of certainty that ours is the right side, is so seductive. It's hard because it means extending empathy and compassion to people who show us hostility and contempt. The impulse to respond in kind is so tempting. But that isn't who we want to be. We can resist, and I will always be inspired to do so by those people I encountered on Twitter, apparent enemies who became my beloved friends. And in the case of one particularly understanding and generous guy, my husband. There was nothing special about the way I responded to him. What was special was their approach. I thought about it a lot over the past few years, and I found four things they did differently that made real conversation possible. These four steps were small but powerful, and I do everything I can to employ them in difficult conversations today. The first is, don't assume bad intent. My friends on Twitter realized that even when my words were aggressive and offensive, I sincerely believed I was doing the right thing. Assuming ill motives almost instantly cuts us off from truly understanding why someone does and believes as they do. We forget that they're a human being with a lifetime of experience that shaped their mind, and we get stuck on that first wave of anger, and the conversation has a very hard time ever moving beyond it. But when we assume good or neutral intent, we give our minds a much stronger framework for dialogue. The second is ask questions. When we engage people across ideological divides, asking questions helps us map the disconnect between our differing points of view. That's important because we can't present effective arguments if we don't understand where the other side is actually coming from, and because it gives them an opportunity to point out flaws in our positions. But asking questions serves another purpose. It signals to someone that they're being heard. When my friends on Twitter stopped accusing and started asking questions, I almost automatically mirrored them. Their questions gave me room to speak, but they also gave me permission to ask them questions and to truly hear their responses. It fundamentally changed the dynamic of our conversation. The third is stay calm. This takes practice and patience, but it's powerful. At Westboro, I learned not to care how my manner of speaking affected others. I thought my rightness justified my rudeness. Harsh tones, raised voices, insults, interruptions. But that strategy is ultimately counterproductive. Dialing up the volume and the snark is natural in stressful situations, but it tends to bring the conversation to an unsatisfactory, explosive end. When my husband was still just an anonymous Twitter acquaintance, our discussions frequently became hard and pointed, but he always refused to escalate. Instead, he would change the subject. He would tell a joke or recommend a book or gently excuse himself from the conversation. We knew the discussion wasn't over, just paused for a time to bring us back to an even keel. People often lament that digital communication makes us less civil, but this is one advantage that online conversations have over in-person ones. We have a buffer of time and space between us and the people whose ideas we find so frustrating. We can use that buffer. Instead of lashing out, we can pause, breathe, change the subject, or walk away, and then come back to it when we're ready. And finally, make the argument. This might seem obvious, but one side effect of having strong beliefs is that we sometimes assume that the value of our position is or should be obvious and self-evident, that we shouldn't have to defend our positions because they're so clearly right and good, that if someone doesn't get it, it's their problem, that it's not my job to educate them. But if it were that simple, we would all see things the same way. As kind as my friends on Twitter were, if they hadn't actually made their arguments, it would have been so much harder for me to see the world in a different way. We are all a product of our upbringing, and our beliefs reflect our experiences. We can't expect others to spontaneously change their own minds. If we want change, we have to make the case for it. My friends on Twitter didn't abandon their beliefs or their principles, only their scorn. They channeled their infinitely justifiable offense and came to me with pointed questions tempered with kindness and humor. They approached me as a human being, and that was more transformative than two full decades of outrage, disdain, and violence. I know that some might not have the time or the energy or the patience for extensive engagement, but as difficult as it can be, reaching out to someone we disagree with is an option that is available to all of us. And I sincerely believe that we can do hard things, not just for them, but for us and our future. Escalating disgust and intractable conflict are not what we want for ourselves or our country or our next generation. My mom said something to me a few weeks before I left Westboro, when I was desperately hoping there was a way I could stay with my family. People I have loved with every pulse of my heart since even before I was that chubby-cheeked five-year-old standing on a picket line holding a sign I couldn't read. She said, "You're just a human being, my dear, sweet child." She was asking me to be humble, not to question, but to trust God and my elders. But to me, she was missing the bigger picture, that we're all just human beings, that we should be guided by that most basic fact and approach one another with generosity and compassion. Each one of us contributes to the communities and the cultures and the societies that we make up. The end of this spiral of rage and blame begins with one person who refuses to indulge these destructive, seductive impulses. We just have to decide that it's going to start with us. Thank you.
That was a TED Talk by Megan Phelps Roper. TED's mission is to spread great ideas and spark conversation. Visit their website at TED.com.
Stand up proud, let's all be human. 'Cause love can only be right.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Michael Lebeau and Michelle Yeager contributed program material with thanks as always to Steve Pride. The Monkees and The L Project performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. You can get involved by logging on to thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio at aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KSKQ Ashland, Oregon, for ZZZ Brisbane, Queensland, WBCR Great Barrington, Massachusetts, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
This Way Out has been brought to you by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts. Freshly prepared foods with an international flavor and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park, with local artisans, international food, and live music. Visit PortlandSaturdayMarket.com for more. And now another episode of This Way Out.
On the public bus one day, some boys were criticizing me. I said, I'm an equal citizen of Bangladesh. And he said, I know where you live. I will throw acid in your face.
The Postal Service stated that the stamp reflects the values of modern Sweden.
It's very easy to box Muslims in one group and say they're homophobic and all the blah, 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 and then not see the diversity among them.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Europe's Human Rights Court slams Russia's no-promo homo law, a gay Bangladeshi blogger flees for his life, and rejected Muslim and queer minorities rally round revolutionary love. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending June 24th, 2017. The European Court of Human Rights declared this week that Russia's so-called no-promo homo law is discriminatory, reinforces stigma and prejudice, and encourages homophobia. The legislation bans any public expression of support for LGBTQ rights that could be witnessed by minors, including pride events, as gay propaganda. The ruling was almost unanimous. The lone holdout, not surprisingly, was the judge from Russia. The case arose after three activists who were convicted of protesting anti-gay discrimination in separate actions from 2009 to 2012 challenged the law, which was enacted in 2013. The Strasbourg-based court dismissed the Russian government's argument that the law protected public morality, ruling that it had failed to demonstrate how freedom of expression on LGBT issues would devalue or otherwise adversely affect actual and existing traditional families or would compromise their future. The law, the judges ruled, embodied a predisposed bias on the part of a heterosexual majority against a homosexual minority. They ordered Russia to pay each of the activists involved in the case from 8 to 20,000 euros in damages. The Russian Justice Ministry vowed to appeal the ruling. A statement insisted that the law was solely designed to defend morality and children's health, and was not a ban or public condemnation of homosexuality. Veteran rights activist Nikolai Alexeyev, one of the activists in the case, strongly disagreed. He told Reuters that the law had nothing to do with protecting minors and was specifically designed to remove LGBT people from the public space and strip them of their right to speak out or fight for their rights.
In a setback for LGBTQ rights in the United States, a three-judge panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has overturned a temporary ban on the implementation of a state law in Mississippi that allows blatant bias against sexual and gender minorities. It permits merchants and government workers to refuse to serve LGBTQ people based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. It also states that gender at birth is immutable, thereby denying any legal recognition to transgender people. Critics call it the most draconian of the numerous so-called religious liberty laws popping up across the country. U.S. District Court Judge Carlton Reeves blocked the law from taking effect last year, saying that it unconstitutionally establishes preferred beliefs and creates unequal treatment for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. In supporting the law, however, the three-judge Fifth Circuit panel didn't directly uphold its constitutionality. They decided instead that the plaintiffs against the state had no legal standing because the law had not gone into effect, so they could not claim that they had suffered any harm from it. Mississippi's Attorney General Jim Hood, a Democrat, refused to appeal the lower court ruling, so Republican Governor Phil Bryant hired lawyers from the far-right Alliance Defending Freedom to do it. Bryant said last year that he'd rather be crucified than repeal the law. According to the Campaign for Southern Equality, one of several legal groups fighting the law, it won't go into effect until the Fifth Circuit certifies the three-judge panel's decision. If, as requested, the Fifth Circuit agrees instead to review the case en banc, that is, by all of the judges of the court, the preliminary injunction preventing enforcement of the law will remain in effect until the full court rules. An appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court by whichever side loses is almost a certainty.
Germany's Federal Constitutional Court, the nation's highest court, rejected an effort by the opposition Green Party this week to force a parliamentary vote on marriage equality before September's national election. The Greens, as well as Parliament's upper house, have proposed legislation to open civil marriage to same-gender couples. Chancellor Angela Merkel's governing coalition is divided on the issue, and the lower house's Legal Affairs Committee has repeatedly found ways to avoid dealing with it. Germany has offered less than equal civil partnerships to gay and lesbian couples since 2001, but Merkel and her allies have consistently rejected civil marriage proposals.
In other news, Sao Paulo, Brazil hosted the 21st edition of what is arguably the world's largest annual LGBTQ pride parade on June 17th. Organizers said they expected at least 3 million people, but no official estimates were released. Many media outlets reported more than 10 city blocks packed with people along the downtown parade route. The event has become a major source of income for Sao Paulo. The theme of the parade this year was Secular State, in response to growing attacks on LGBTQ rights by religious fundamentalists. Whatever our beliefs, said the official slogan, no religion is law, all for a secular state. Parade organizer Claudia Regina warned on the parade's official Facebook page that far-right religious forces are intent on removing the rights that we have already obtained. Despite its many legal advances, including marriage equality, mostly Roman Catholic Brazil is one of the most dangerous places in the world to be LGBTQ. More than 340 hate-sparked murders of sexual and gender minorities were reported in the country last year, almost one every day. More than 160 have already been reported this year. But draft legislation on gender identity and classification of homophobia as a crime have each stalled in Parliament for years. And in April, Brazil's Football Association was fined because of its supporters' chanting of homophobic slogans during World Cup qualifying.
More than 5,000 police officers protected about 2,500 pride marchers in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev, also on June 17th. Far-right nationalists posted death threats to the organizers on the day of the march, warning that it would end in a bloodbath. The route was redirected after protesters filled the main street the march had been planned to go down, but the rerouted parade remained generally peaceful and upbeat. About 200 protesters occasionally scuffled with police along the route. Two officers were injured and six protesters were arrested for trying to breach the security cordon. Britain's ambassador to the Ukraine, Judith Goff, was among the foreign diplomats who joined the prideful procession. Marchers waving Ukrainian and rainbow flags chanted, "We're different, we're equal," and "Ukraine for all." Organizers tried to hold Ukraine's first ever Pride March in 2014, but city officials banned it after police refused to protect the participants. Right-wing protesters disrupted the parade in 2015 by throwing smoke bombs at the marchers. Kiev's first peaceful Pride March drew about 1,500 participants last year.
Istanbul authorities banned a planned Pride March on June 24th, a day before it was scheduled to take place, claiming that the appropriate application had not been received. A media statement also said that the march was being banned for the security of participants and tourists and public order. Far-right groups had threatened to violently attack the marchers if authorities allowed the event to go forward. Peaceful pride parades were held in Istanbul for more than a decade, and the 2014 edition drew up to 100,000 people, making it one of the largest celebrations of LGBTQ pride in the Muslim world. But opponents violently disrupted the march in 2015, and it's been banned ever since. Amnesty International joined other global human rights groups and local activists to condemn this year's denial, saying in a statement that Turkey should protect gay pride rather than banning it.
But about 3,500 people celebrated at the first ever LGBTQ Pride Parade in the southern Israeli city of Beersheba on June 22nd. The Times of Israel reported that two ultra-Orthodox Jewish men, one carrying a knife, were arrested nearby. One had tried to forcibly enter the procession. 2 years ago, teenager Shira Bunky was killed and five other people were injured in a knife attack by a Jewish extremist at a Pride Parade in central Jerusalem. Hundreds of police, border guards, and volunteers were deployed to protect the Beersheba marchers. The city's pride events have been smaller in previous years, usually taking place at a local youth center. This year marked its first full-fledged public parade. Despite the potential for violence, no incidents were reported.
And finally, German-Turkish women's rights activist Sirin Ates has opened the first LGBTQ-friendly mosque in Berlin. Dozens of people gathered for its inaugural Friday prayers on June 16th inside a Protestant church located in the immigrant Berlin neighborhood of Moabit. This project was long overdue, Ates said, adding that she hopes the mosque will one day have its own building. There's so much Islamist terror and so much evilness happening in the name of my religion. It's important that we, the modern and liberal Muslims, also show our faces in public. Ates told reporters that she plans to start Arabic and Islamic studies later this year and hopes to become an imam herself. She said she wants all Muslims to be able to pray together in her mosque. Our goal is to offer a place to worship to all people that do not feel at home in the existing mosques, she said, to women that seek equal rights, to homosexuals, and primarily to all separate Muslim denominations, Alawites, Sunnis, and Shias. Here, she noted, we do not tell anyone what a good Muslim is and what a bad one is.
That's News Wrap for the week ending June 24th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
In late-breaking news from Istanbul, police initiated riot control tactics to stop activists' attempts to march with pride on June 25th, despite the governor's ban. Demonstrators who dodged checkpoints near the site of the announced ad hoc rally were met with tear gas and rubber bullets, and at least 100 were arrested. Small protests continue to spring up into the evening. We'll report further developments on the next This Way Out.
I'm lucky to be part of both the queer community and also the Muslim community, that I get the best of both of them right now.
As the fasting of Ramadan gives way to the feasting of Eid, LGBTQ Muslims are standing up and speaking out. We'll hear from one activist working in the States later in the program. But first... Bangladesh is not a healthy place for dissenters these days, especially LGBTQ people. One 23-year-old gay man found safety among queer sisters and brothers in Nepal and an opportunity to tell his story to Rajan Parajuli of KBR Jakarta's Asia Calling.
Amar rakhal mon gaan ge jai, yamar desh.
Mehmood Rakibul Hassan, or Rakib for short, has been living inside a small meeting room at the Blue Diamond Society. It's a group of activists that supports sexual minorities in the capital, Kathmandu.
I have two blankets. This one for bichhane ke liye.
These are two pieces of cloth. I use one as a mattress and another as a blanket. One Nepali friend gave me them.
Rakib shows me the thin blanket he spreads out on the floor each night. It's winter here, and at night, temperatures hit close to freezing. When I first met Rakib, he hadn't eaten a meal for 3 days. Every few days, he cooks a packet of instant noodles because that's all he can afford. Rakib first fled from home in 2009 after he came out to his parents.
Mom bola, it's like a habit. It's just tumara mentally thinking, tumara thinking change karo.
My mother said, it's not natural, it's okay, just your thinking, so change it. She said, the day I became normal, they will accept me. They took me to the psychiatrist, but the psychiatrist harassed me and told me I was the problem for society. And people like me are the root cause of HIV. He gave me different pills, but things didn't change.
At home, Rakib's father refused to eat with him at the same table. And when he prayed in the mosque, his family told him the seat he had used would remain impure for a month. So Rakib packed up a few belongings, some clothes, a few books, and about $200. And he took the 12-hour bus to Dhaka. In the capital, Rakib and his friends formed a youth organization called Rubban. They published a magazine, wrote blogs, and organized awareness programs, urging people to speak out against discrimination and violence against sexual minorities. They voice against horrific acts such as those he had experienced himself.
The police caught me when I was coming out of the park one day, and they accused me of being a sex worker. They said they would file a case against me. They forcefully took me to a public toilet and started touching me everywhere. They harassed me. I kicked them and they burned cigarettes on my back. They raped me and threw me on the road. I had no one to support me if they filed the case, so I had no choice but to keep quiet.
Before he fled, Rakib was writing for a magazine called Muktamona. That was before the magazine's editor, Abhijit Roy, was killed by Islamic fundamentalists. 8 other bloggers who wrote about gay and lesbian issues were also killed.
He was a blogger. He was killed by fundamental. LGBT free egg blog.
When Islamic fundamentalists killed Abhijit Roy, the founding editor of Muktamona, we were very scared. I also used to write for Muktamona. On the public bus one day, some boys were criticizing me. I said, I'm an equal citizen of Bangladesh. And he said, I know where you live. You will end up like your blogger friends. I will throw acid in your face. That really scared me a lot.
Fearing for his life, Rakib decided to leave. He fled to Nepal in April last year, hoping he might be safer here. Rakib hasn't seen his family for more than 6 years now. They don't even know he's in another country. Rakib tries to call his mother on Skype every week, but she won't pick up.
Every day, maybe they blocked me.
The person you're trying to reach is currently unavailable.
Unavailable. Actually, I tried lots of them. Daily, I tried to call them and reach them, but from there, they have no reply or they have no anything.
Here in Nepal, Rakib has been recognized as a refugee by the Office of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, UNHCR. But for now, he is waiting for a host country to take him in. The other option, returning home, would mean he would have to lie about his sexuality, something he isn't prepared to do. For now, when Rakib misses home, he sings the national anthem softly to himself.
Tumar akash, tumar batash, amar prane, omay amar prane bajay bashi.
For Asia Calling, this is Rajan Parajuli in Kathmandu.
Our thanks to Asia Calling producer Nicole Kirby for sharing that moving interview.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Minnesota's Caravan of Love is ready for boarding after we check the mailbox for a special delivery from Sweden.
A Stamp for Pride, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. The Postal Service of Sweden issued the world's first postage stamp featuring the LGBT Rainbow Pride flag on May 4, 2016. The flag, which covers the entire stamp, features six horizontal stripes in red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and violet. The red stripe is on top, as it is in a natural rainbow. The original design for the Pride flag came from San Francisco artist Gilbert Baker in 1978. Since then, it has undergone several revisions. The stamp was created by artist Lisa Rydell. She came up with the idea during a long summer walk in 2014. The Postal Service stated that the stamp reflects the values of modern Sweden. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Robin Bentley.
Let's sound a fanfare for this week's second anniversary of U.S. marriage equality.
Now available on CD or by download.
Attention all LGBT, U.S. history buffs, collectors, and listener supporters.
You can now own a very special edition of This Way Out.
Here's a taste.
Today, being gay is not a crime.
This is going to lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
This is social engineering by a court.
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
Congratulations.
Today, some of the darkest 24 hours in our nation's history.
It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
From outlaws to in-laws traces the legal evolution of the U.S. Supreme Court.
From the decriminalization of private consensual adult gay sex in 2003 to making marriage equality the law of the land in 2015.
This special edition features the voices of dozens of equality advocates over those years who made the journey possible.
Despite always outspoken opposition along the way.
From outlaws to in-laws also includes a wide variety of thematic music.
You'll find all the info you need about this very special edition of This Way Out at
thiswayout.org.
Well, isn't that special?
Now available on CD or by download.
Noor Gibran is a queer Muslim activist whose inspiring intersectional work grows out of his faith as well as his political science PhD studies at the University of Minnesota. He explained how his thesis led to his post-Pulse massacre organizing efforts in an interview with This Way Out correspondents Dixie Trichel and John Townsend.
I identify as gay, I'm Muslim, I am from Afghanistan, I was born and brought up there. I came here through a scholarship, finished that, and then continued with my PhD in political science. My work is on masculinities, political violence, war, and also diaspora. And studies that look into the immigrant and refugee communities, there's always this ambiguous understanding of gender and sexuality among them. The white communities, gender and sexuality is considered to be of the desired one and of the dominant one, and they do not understand sexuality and gender among people of color and also among refugees and immigrants here. And my work does that. My work looks into how war impacts that. And when refugees and immigrants come here, they come with trauma of war and violence that is already masculine. And of, especially in the Muslim world, they come also with a history of the U.S. imperialism, U.S. military occupations and invasions.
Noor, tell us about Minnesota Caravan of Love.
Minnesota Caravan of Love is a group of Muslims, women, women of color mainly, and queer people who have come together and establishing this caravan that promotes love and coexistence among different communities, immigrants, refugees, and also LGBTQ communities. Was established in the aftermath of Orlando massacre last year, when the entire LGBTQ communities around the United States and as well as around the world was shaken, and as well as the Muslim community, because they were being blamed for what happened, whereas we all know that Orlando happened because of toxic masculinity. The aftermath of Orlando witnessed a rise of homonationalism around the United States. Within that, tried to get the queer community against Muslims, and that promoted a whitewash queer existence in the United States and completely ignoring the existence of queer Muslims who are being affected by these laws and policies in the United States, and literally putting these two communities who are already marginalized, Muslims and LGBTQ communities, against each other. In a response to that, and in order to fight and challenge those norms and ideas and policies, we came together to show existence of queer Muslims and their Muslim allies, that Muslims are very diverse.
Are there other groups around the nation, do you know of, that are trying to pull the LGBT community and Muslim community together?
There is some iftar events happening around the country that is mostly just mainstream Muslims.
Well, CAIR, they're doing quite a bit too.
Yes, Unity Iftar that happened just past week was also partnered with CAIR. There's a lot of exclusions happen in a lot of those settings.
I just know that some of the CAIR chapters were very forthcoming in expressing condolences about the Pulse killings last year. You know, they stepped up to the plate.
It was very surprising to us and very heartwarming to witness that, because I had never ever imagined that we would hear our Muslim leaders around the nation, because they have been continuously painted or portrayed as homophobic everywhere, because it's very easy to box Muslims in one group and say they're homophobic and all the blah blah blah, and then not see the diversity among them. And CAIR was the first organization actually that came up and in support of LGBT communities and condemning the attack. CAIR is one organization, and also there is the Masjid. It's another organization that is of DC and New York that's actually led by queer Muslims, and that is for gender and sexuality equality.
You're currently celebrating Ramadan.
Ramadan is the holy month of fasting that around the Muslim world, and it's celebrated widely. A lot of people think that Ramadan is just about shutting your mouth, not eating. It's more, the concentration is more about charity, giving, being generous to those who don't have food on their table. Also sharing with your family members. It's literally for us Christmas for 30 days, eating together. And also at the same time, when we fast, the philosophy behind is to feel the hunger of those who do not have food in their stomach, who sleep hungry and or they're thirsty. And we are celebrating that together with Pride this year. And luckily, the past 2 years, Ramadan has coincided with Pride, which I am lucky to be part of both the queer community and also the Muslim community, that I get the best of both of them.
Noor Gibran spoke with Dixie Trichel and John Townsend during Ramadan. Eid Mubarak, Noor. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week, Francis O'Brien and Christopher Gall, produced by Steve Pride, Rajan Parajuli, produced by Nicole Kirby, Robin Bentley, produced by Jeb Proctor and Brian Burns, and Dixie Trichel and John Townsend contributed program material. Mishari Rashid Alafasi performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and our listener donors for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com. or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Richard Chappelle and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on South Ribble Community Radio, Lancashire, England, WBAI, New York, New York, KUGS, Bellingham, Washington, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stand proud and stay tuned.
Hello, KABU members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KABU Board of Directors is essential. Here's an opportunity for you to join the KABU Board and become part of the team that is guiding our daily work and representing the interests and visions of all our members. Please consider applying to become a KABU Board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There's a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a KABU member. To apply, go to kabu.fm or stop by the station to pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is July 17, 2017. We are looking for folks who love KABU, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KABU's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression,